Okay, so my guest today is Karina Vold. Karina is a philosopher of mind, cognition, and artificial intelligence. She works on the ethical and societal impacts of emerging technologies and their effects on human cognition. Dr. Vold is currently a postdoctoral research associate at the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence and a research fellow at the Faculty of Philosophy and a digital charter fellow at the Alan Turing Institute. She received her PhD in philosophy from McGill University, and she'll be joining the faculty of Carleton College as an assistant professor in philosophy, humanities, and technology in fall 2020. So welcome to the show, Karina.
Hi, Don. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to kind of meet you virtually, I guess.
Yeah.
I've read a number of your articles, so it's nice to get to chat.
Ditto, and I think most of my academic contexts are virtual these days. It's a reflection of the world that we live in.
It is, yeah.
So, look, we're going to try and talk today about the ethics of extended cognition, particularly as it pertains to the use of AI extension of cognition. So that's a topic that you've written a couple of papers about, and I believe you're also researching as part of an augmented intelligence project at the Leverhulme Center.
Yes.
All right. So, and I first came across your writings actually in Aeon magazine. I'm not sure how you pronounce the title of the magazine. You wrote a piece about the extended mind thesis and smartphones, I think, was the main focus in that piece. And you also have written a longer piece, which I read more recently, about AI extenders, the ethical and societal implications of humans cognitively extended by AI. And that was co-authored with Jose Hernandez Orallo.
Yes.
So we're probably going to focus mainly on the arguments and ideas in that latter paper, but you know, we might drift on to other issues depending on how this conversation evolves. So let me first ask you a question about the concept or phenomenon of cognitive extension or augmented intelligence. Now, I think like philosophers would like to define concepts and terms here initially, but I thought maybe we wouldn't do that, and instead we would try and give some concrete examples of alleged cognitive extension. Mm-hmm. And you know, we can debate them afterwards as to whether they are genuine cases of cognitive extension. And this is something you do in that paper you wrote with Jose. You present a very detailed taxonomy of the different ways in which AI is being or could be used to augment cognition. So maybe we could just discuss a few examples from that list that you have. And I guess an obvious place to start is the extension of memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So first, I just wanted to say thanks for mentioning my co-author. So Jose Hernandez Orallo, who's based at the Polytechnic University of Valencia, co-authored with me on this paper. And we also have a second paper on the same topic or similar topic, but looking at how AI extenders could be used to sort of shed light on mental health or improve mental health. And he has a background in computer science, so it's been really excellent collaboration. So I think you're right that memory is a great place to start. So of course, a lot of the examples of the extended mind and extended cognition tend to begin with memory. I think it's in part because of Andy Clark and David Chalmers, the philosophers who defended and really popularized the idea of cognitive extension. In their original 1998 paper, they used an example of a person named Otto who relied on his notebook to write down and store important information and then accessed that information whenever he needed it. And they argued that in many relevant respects, Otto is just like you or I or any of us who have good, working, reliable internal memory. So when he needs information, he looks it up, and when he relies on that information to successfully guide his actions. And so similarly, we started with an example of how AI could be used to extend our memories. There's sort of some trivial examples in which, you know, well, at the time that Andy Clark and David Chalmers were writing, there were no smartphones. There's a lot of examples more recently of how we use smartphones to offload important information, just like we may have once done in physical notebooks. So a common example I give is phone numbers. So I'm old enough to remember a time when I had to remember my own phone numbers, as well as the phone numbers of all my friends and family, Whereas nowadays, I barely know my own phone number, and all of that is just stored in my phone. So there's a sort of simple sense in which some of these digital technologies are taking over some of the functions of our biological brains. But I think that phones in 2019 are even more sophisticated. So basically, all of our phones have a neural network hardware, and increasingly, the apps we use are exploiting deep learning. So just a couple quick examples are cognitive assistants already remind us of events or appointments, and Facebook and Apple products will typically prompt memories by showing you old posts in your feed. But also in the future, I mean, Jose and I sort of thought, well, you know, what could be done that isn't being done now? And you might think that there's some more sophisticated ways that AI could be used to improve long-term memory, for example, by introducing new customized mnemonics or by improving episodic memory. So tagging our experiences with related people, concepts, and other situations, for example.
The example of the kind of, you know, Facebook reminding you of past events in your life, or various calendar assistants or AI assistants reminding you of events that you have scheduled, they strike me as being like more interesting than just purely outsourcing the storage of information, which is, I think like what a lot of people imagine when they think about how technology assists with memory. You know, that all the information is stored in Google and we just kind of access it in some way. But now we're kind of seeing these slightly more sophisticated, more interesting ways of coordinating with human memory. And that seems to me a step up beyond just an external storage device.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think there's something interesting that's going on here too. And I guess we'll get more into this as we go on. But I guess one of the questions I've been sort of thinking a lot about is, why should we talk about this category of AI extenders as being distinct from typical cases of cognitive artifacts that have long been discussed by extended mind theorists? And I want to give an answer something like what you're suggesting, which is that there's something more interesting going on where it's a bit of a back and forth. It's not a static device. It's contributing something to sort of the nature of what's being extended. And also, I think it's more sophisticated.
Yeah, I mean, we can get back to maybe that discussion of like what exactly is different about this kind of extension as opposed to some historical examples. But I just wanted to flag that at the outset. I mean, some of the other examples of different cognitive processes, the next one you discussed in the article is sensory-motor interaction. What do you mean by that, and how can AI extend sensory-motor interaction?
Yeah, and I'll give some shorter answers to these examples. We know that AI systems, so machine learning, deep learning systems, are very good at perceiving and recognizing patterns and even manipulating patterns in different ways than we can. And they can do that through sensory and actuator modalities. So in other words, we can have new sensors that can be intelligently translated into ways that are understood by our sensors. So the kind of example I have in mind here, and in some ways, I would love to have Jose here to also talk about what he has in mind. But to try to make this more concrete, you can imagine how sensors on your car, for example, are being translated into information like beeps and buzzes that alert you of objects that are in your immediate environment that you weren't aware of. So you're translating something that's happening that's beyond your awareness into something that's more concrete and aware to you.
Yeah, that's an interesting example. I can think of other cases where you're using some kind of detection device that can detect like a frequency of light waves or something,
right?
That you can't ordinarily. Actually, one example that springs to mind, which I discuss in a book that I've just published, is this guy Neil Harbison. He's this artist.
Yes.
He has a device that translates light frequencies into sound waves, into different patterns of sound. So that's kind of an interesting, I don't know if it's an extension it's certainly a way of varying the normal kind of sensory interaction with the world. So you're transducing one kind of sensory signal into another that becomes interpretable by the human mind in a different way.
So, that's right. And there's some examples of, I think it's some Duke researchers who did something similar to the brain of a mouse. So making a mouse sensitive to the electromagnetic spectrum, which is something they're not naturally sensitive to. Yeah, so you can also think about being sort of an actual physical mutation or something that's much more deeply embedded.
Okay, so like, what about other examples of extension then? I mean, you discuss lots of them in the paper, so I'm willing to kind of go wherever you want in terms of like what are the most interesting examples from your perspective.
Okay, good. Yeah, so I think attention is kind of interesting one. So we know, for example, that there's a sort of classic experiment in psychology called the invisible gorilla, which for those listeners who aren't familiar, is a case where you're sort of shown a video of some basketball players passing a basketball around. And meanwhile, in the background, a person dressed in a gorilla suit walks by the screen. And in a lot of cases, people who view this video don't really even notice the gorilla because they're so focused on the activity in the foreground. This experiment sort of shows how easily humans overlook very important things in their environment. And lots of other research shows that our attention spans are short and not very accurate. So we had this idea that, look, AI systems are actually really good at modeling our interests, our goals. And if it were to do that, if you had a system that knew what you were interested in, knew what you were looking for, and knew what you ought to be paying attention to, the sort of things that you might miss, it could search through information or focus your attention on things that you might otherwise overlook.
So, I mean, that's an interesting example. I think we may come back to that when it comes to some of the ethics of this, because I have concerns about certainly the way in which AI is currently being used to control human attention, which I think is probably problematic in various senses. Any other kind of interesting examples to do with like other cognitive processes, like, I don't know, communication or social interaction, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think the ones that I find really interesting most recently, in part because of some of the things I've been thinking about in terms of what distinguishes AI extenders, are emotional and self-control. So some people would argue that AI is becoming better than humans at emotional intelligence, and certainly at least some people amongst us aren't very good at detecting emotions in others. We aren't very good at sort of mind modeling and trying to understand what other people are thinking. And so not only can you have systems that model your interests and goals, which is something that we've seen a lot of in recent years with AI systems, you could also have systems that model the interests and goals of people in your network and try to help you understand, you know, what are these people thinking and what's an appropriate emotional response to that exchange. So a little bit of helping with self-understanding. And likewise, so sort of related to that, another one I think is interesting that we discussed in the paper is metacognition. And metacognition sort of broadly is cognition about cognition or one's awareness or understanding of their own thought processes. And so I think AI has this potential to be able to model you in a way that you don't understand yourself and to give you some awareness of the things that you're good at and not so good at, and then potentially to help with capabilities and strategies to help you navigate situations more optimally.
Now that we have some kind of concrete examples, could we, let's maybe get into the more philosophical discussion of like how we define and understand extended cognition, and also I think how we differentiate it from some related forms of cognition that people discuss. So maybe you start with like, how would you define what it means to extend cognition? And we can talk about how that applies back to the examples in a moment.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess the starting place for me is something like the parity argument that Clark and Chalmers discuss. So to start with a definition. So I think of extended cognition is the claim that there's really more to your mind than just your brain. So some of the tools and technologies you use can become so functionally essential to your cognition as the synapses firing in your head. So they can become literally constitutive parts of your mind. And then working back from that, you might think, well, how could that be the case? And the argument that Clark and Chalmers have given back in 98 was to appeal first to the kind of common notion of what thinking was, so appealing to arguably our best science of the mind, something like cognitive neuroscience, which says that thinking is a process of symbol manipulation that's typically carried out by the brain, but that that might be carried out by something other than the brain. And so then they give some arguments, like the example of auto I mentioned, and try to make the claim that, in fact, there are things in our environment that really do play the same role as neurons in our brain. So that's kind of roughly the structure of people who defend cognitive extension. There's been a movement, sort of the second wave movement of cognitive extension, where people try not to appeal to this kind of parody style argument, but instead argue that the technologies we use can actually do things far and beyond what our brains could do. But those things should also count as constitutive parts of our mind.
Right. So, I mean, I think this is probably an important point. So the Clark and Chalmers paper on the extended mind, which we have discussed on this podcast before.
Okay.
So for people who have listened to previous episodes, and I'll include a link to it. As you point out, that focuses very much on the notion of, the parody notion of, like, what's basically the same. So the use of, mm-hmm. Otto's use of the notebook to remember things in their paper, their example, it's the same as what a human would be doing if they were relying on whatever part of the brain is relevant to remembering, like the hippocampus or something. I can't remember, or I don't know the exact details, but the point is that, see, he happens to be relying on an external device, and he has this interdependent relationship with the external device. Normal humans, let's say, rely heavily on parts of their brain for this relationship, but it doesn't really matter where exactly the relationship arises or what constitutes it. It doesn't matter if it's a part of your brain or it's a notebook. It's all the same thing. They're equivalent in that respect. But this other step is to say, well, it's not just that they're equivalent. These external artifacts, technologies that we rely upon in cognition, they can actually augment and expand our mm-hmm. innate cognitive abilities.
Right.
Yeah.
So they might go far and beyond what could be done by just our bare brains. And I think actually even Clark and Chalmers are, you know, they want to be able to endorse examples like that too. My sense is that the parody argument was a sort of way of getting this whole sort of field off the ground. And they might also be quite amenable to some of the sort of cognitive integration or complementarity arguments that are now on the table.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect Andy Clark is definitely a fan of that view.
Yeah.
David Chalmers probably hasn't, I don't know if he's expressed many opinions about it since. He seems to kind of have less follow-up on this idea than Clark has had. But yeah, I presume he probably is attracted to that idea as well. What are the distinctions? Yeah, like I wanted to discuss a potential distinction between extended cognition and extended mind, because at least to me, the extended mind is potentially a more controversial thesis than just the notion that we use artifacts to help in the process of cognition, and we have highly dependent relationships. Because the extended mind hypothesis, as originally formulated, is this strong claim that these external artifacts are actually part of our mind. Like they are functional mental states, I guess, supervene upon the relationship between the brain and the external artifact. It's not just that there is this dependency relationship per se.
Yeah. This is always a funny distinction to talk about because I think it's not really consistent in the literature. But maybe a way of thinking about this, or at least, you know, this is how I think about it, and it may be controversial. So I think of the mark of the mental, or the mark of mentality, traditionally includes either intentionality, consciousness, or both. And you might think of things that are mental, or what we count as a part of sort of that space, are things that are at the personal level, or at least could be at the personal level. Whereas the mark of the cognitive is sort of slightly less obvious to me, but we might say that it includes things like subpersonal mechanisms, like visual processing, so things that you couldn't even really bring into consciousness. And I have to say, I'm definitely guilty of blurring these two together when I write. Sometimes I just add a footnote saying I mean these pretty much in the same way. But I think you are right as well in that the claim about extended mind, for example, Clark and Chalmers have a separate section where they talk about extended mind as distinct from extended cognition. And that's where they really start to introduce the idea that the symbols in Otto's notebook are representational vehicles. So they're the vehicles of his mental representations, just like the neurons in Inga's brain are the representational vehicles of her beliefs. So they sort of move to that more traditional language of mental representations.
Yeah, like one way of getting at this, which I was going to talk about later, but I think it actually makes sense to talk about it now, is there's a famous objection to the Clark and Chalmers thesis from Ken Adams and I can't remember the other guy's name. Fred Adams and Ken Ozawa, yeah.
Yeah.
So they have this thing called the coupling constitution fallacy.
That's right.
Right. So they say that there are two kinds of relationships you can have with, I guess, with anything, but in this context with some external cognitive artifact, there can be a kind of relationship of causal dependency. So that the brain is coupled to this external artifact such that there is a causal connection between them. Mm. Or you can have a compositional relationship where they basically just form the same single system, the same mind, the same thinking device, in a sense. And mm-hmm. so they would argue, and I might be messing up their argument, but they would argue that, of course, we're coupled to external artifacts. We have causal relationships and we depend upon them, but that doesn't mean that our minds are constituted by this relationship between the brain and the external artifact. It's not that the process of thinking supervenes on both sets of mm-hmm. events, the events inside your head and the events outside your head. It's just that there's a causal dependency between what's happening outside your head with what's happening inside your head. I don't know if that's formulating it correctly, but what would you say about that objection anyway?
Yeah, so and they would say something similar to, I mean, I think they give the example where, you know, your circulatory system is coupled to your nervous system, but we can still distinguish these systems. So we don't say that the heart is partly, or that your thinking is partly constituted by your heart. So there's just a sort of coupling relationship there. I think they use a similar objection to sort of get around some of the embodied cognition arguers or defenders as well.
Just before you move on to discuss their how to respond to it, I mean, could you actually define that concept as well of embodied cognition? How does that differ from extended cognition?
Sorry. Yeah, definitely. So there's a whole group of related views. Sort of an umbrella term for them is situated cognition. This is how I think of the landscape, at least. And situated cognition is comprised of at least four, maybe five different views, which include embodied, embedded, extended, inactive, and I would say distributed cognition. And all of those views, I think what kind of holds them together is that in each of their own ways, they push back against some of the traditional commitments of cognitive science, commitments that situated cognition theorists like myself argue are a bit too wrapped up in the Cartesian tradition of thinking of the mind as this distinct sort of dualistic approach to the mind. And so the way that
if I could just come in. So if you take the classical Cartesian view is that the mind is located in some non-physical realm, but the physicalist updating of that view is that basically the mind is just located in the brain.
That's right.
And so all these other views, which you group under the label of situated cognition, are denying that thesis, that cognition, that the mind is brain bound or limited to the boundaries of the brain, so to speak.
That's a great way of summing it up. Thanks, John. And not just that commitment, but also some of the traditional commitments of cognitive science that came out of that kind of Cartesian era. So including things like representationalism and maybe even computationalism to some extent. So the embodied mind theorists will argue for the claim that the mind is more than just the brain. The mind is really constituted by the entire biological organism, or at least critical parts of that organism. And there's a sort of host of different arguments for that thesis, which we can get into if you like. And then embedded cognition theorists, I think, are open to emphasizing the extent to which things outside of both the brain and the body causally interact with, and to some extent that the mind is causally dependent on the world outside of the brain and the body, but they don't go so far as to claim that the mind is actually constituted by those external things. So you might think it's kind of a step in the direction of the extended mind. And then the extended mind thesis we've already discussed, it says that things outside the brain, the body, really can constitute a part of your mind. And then in activists, I think in particular, push back not only against that internalist commitment, but also the computationalist and representationalist commitments of traditional cognitive science. And then distributed cognition theorists hold a kind of, in some respects, even more radical view, which claims that you can have cognitive processes that sort of take place across multiple organisms and even artifacts in one's environment. So the kind of classic example is Edwin Hutchins' work on two pilots and a cockpit that work together to land a plane.
Right, yeah. So you've got a thinking being that's located in two biological organisms or more, so you have this kind of collective activity as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much he commits to there actually being a kind of
constitution. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, but it's, yeah, the nuances of that I'm less familiar with.
Right, I mean, so let's get back to the coupling constitution fallacy, yeah, in a minute, but I just wanted to maybe put a footnote here, and maybe we can come back to this, which is that all of these views, these situated cognition views, they all kind of pose a lot of problems, don't they, for the traditional project of artificial intelligence, in a sense. Because it's not that we need to effectively just recreate, well, it depends on how you define the traditional project of artificial intelligence, I guess. But if you define it in Turing-like terms, that the goal is to create some kind of human-like thinking object, if it's the case that you're just replicating the brain, that's difficult, but maybe it's relatively easier than trying to replicate all these complex feedback loops and relationships between the body and the environment and other parts of the body as well, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's right. And arguably one of the reasons why we see so many advances in AI in these really domain-specific areas, because sure, you can build a computer that can, you know, or an AI system that can build, beat the world's best player at Go or chess or StarCraft or so forth, and it's not to minimize those accomplishments, but those are very narrow accomplishments. And you might think to build a more general intelligent system, at least something that's more like us, it might require these kind of feedback loops or interactions with an environment.
Yeah, and I think like proponents of embodied cognition would very straightforwardly say that, look, you can't,
right,
you can't create a disembodied mind inside a computer. It's,
or, that's right,
that's going to be like a human. It's not going to have the same kind of general intelligence.
Right.
Anyway, that's a long circuitous loop around the coupling constitution fallacy.
Yes.
So, like, how do you respond to that? This notion that there isn't this constitutive relationship going on. It's just a causal dependency relationship, and the brain is still a separate system from whatever artifacts it happens to rely upon in cognition.
Right. So I think this is one of the strongest objections, arguably, against the extended mind, at least in my view. And there was a long back and forth between Clark and Chalmers, but mostly Clark and Adams and Aizawa about this. And a lot of that back and forth is sort of putting the ball in the other person's court. So it's also, I think it's also difficult for a defender of the sort of embedded view or the internalist view to say exactly why we should only attribute that constitutive relationship to the brain. So to some extent, I think the sort of the ball's in their court to offer a knockdown argument. But sort of dimensions of interactivity that I appeal to typically are things like bidirectionality of connections and stability of connections over time. So is there a kind of back and forth between the object or the tool that's being used and the agent that's using it? Are they using that regularly? So is there a stability of that connection such that the tool is there when it's needed? What is the sort of bandwidth between these effective connections? So how much information is being shared over what amount of time? And how effectively is that information exchanged? So trying to think about really just how tightly coupled are those things, and then the way that I think a lot of extended cognition theorists try to push back then against the objector is to say, look, that actually looks a lot like what the neurons in our brain are doing in relation to each other. So all these different nodes in the internalist network seem to be tightly coupled. They seem to share information really effectively. They seem to have a stability of connections. And so if all those dimensions are holding with respect to some external element, why wouldn't we say that it's also a part of the system? So it's sort of looking at some of the typical guiding principles that people like Herbert Simon discussed in his principle of decomposability of systems.
Yeah, I mean, a really shorthand way of putting it, I guess, then, is just that, like, with a sufficient amount of coupling, if the coupling is very close and interdependent, that seems to be as good as constitution. So this kind of sharp distinction that Adams and Ozawa are drawing between those two phenomena is maybe questionable.
That's right.
Right. So let's talk then about AI-based forms of cognitive extension, and I guess what's different about them in comparison to the classic example. So we had some illustrations of cognitive extension earlier on, but I guess on a more abstract level, what is distinctive about AI-based extension as opposed to, you know, relying on a pen and paper to perform some basic cognitive operations? What's unique and different about this new world we're entering into?
Yeah, right. So part of it is something I mentioned just before, which is bidirectionality. So there's a sense in which Otto interacts with the notebook. So he acts on the notebook, he puts information there, and he perceives the information as well. So there's this action and perception loop. But the notebook itself is a static thing. And that seems to be a little bit different than what's going on today, where there are changes happening in your smartphone that you're potentially completely unaware of. And there's a sense in which it's becoming almost a thinker in itself. So it's what I've been thinking about is that it seems like these AI extenders are sort of somewhere closer to social cognition or socially extended cognition. So the example of, you know, you can imagine Otto relying on his notebook to store information, but you can also imagine Otto relying on Inga, let's say his long-term partner, to store information in her mind. So when he needs to go somewhere like the museum, he asks Inga, you know, where's the museum located? And she tells him. And that makes him vulnerable to all sorts of different things, right? He has to rely on this person who might misremember, or might misrepresent, might manipulate, and so forth. And it looks like an AI extender is a little bit closer to that situation, both in terms of its sophistication, so the kind of capacities it can sort of support, but also in terms of the kind of vulnerabilities that come with it.
This gets to another question, I guess, about this phenomenon of AI-based extension, which is, like, one way of putting it bluntly is that is there really extension going on here at all, or is it even possible? Because I mentioned already that at least classically, the whole program of AI was based around the notion of creating machines that could essentially be functionally equivalent to humans in performing certain cognitive tasks. So in a sense, they were trying to replace human cognition, not so much extend it.
Yeah.
So like, right. Isn't there a sense in which your claim that there's this AI-based cognitive extension is kind of conceptually impossible based on that classic understanding of what AI is supposed to be?
Okay, so there's a little bit to unpack there. So I do think AI, while it's notoriously difficult to define, most definitions do include some explicit requirement for there to be a significant degree of autonomy in the system. And there's, I think, good historical reasons for why that might be, which we can put aside for now. But the idea is that we want to build a system, traditionally an AI, that can solve tasks independently. So that's with limited or no human assistance or manipulation. And there's, I think, a lot of the project within AI, the field of AI even today, is doing something like that. But that aside, there's also a lot of machine learning and deep learning and a lot of the sophisticated software engineering techniques that are developed within the field of AI that are being used in non-autonomous systems. And those are things like navigational systems, or the kind of examples that I gave you earlier, speech recognition systems, visual recognition systems, language translation systems as well. And so those are the kind of like non-autonomous systems that Jose and I were really interested in focusing on in our paper, because those are the ones we think that are being built in a way that could really just support a human.
Right. And so one of the things you do in your paper, which I think is useful, although I may criticize it in a moment, which is this kind of taxonomy, not so much taxonomy, but a spectrum maybe of different kinds of interactions humans can have with AI. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the correct way of phrasing it, but basically you talk about three things could happen when we use AI to assist in the performance of cognitive tasks. There could be externalization, internalization, and extension. So, I mean, we kind of touched upon extension already, but could you maybe explain what you mean by those distinctions and what and how they might arise in a specific example as well?
Yeah, great. So I guess I kind of think of this as like a bit of a spectrum. So on one far end of the spectrum, you have all of this advanced machine learning and deep learning and so forth being used to build completely autonomous systems that operate on their own. So you can think driverless car. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have these different degrees of non-autonomous systems and the ways in which they can support or be used by humans. So the first is something like externalization, as you mentioned, and we describe this as an outsourced service. And the sort of the natural way of thinking about this to me is just like we think about all sorts of artifacts. So extended mind theorists think that some of the tools we use can become a genuine part of our mind, and that depends on them being tightly coupled. But there's also a whole range of stuff that we use that isn't tightly coupled and that we just use it in this kind of unintegrated way. And so that's kind of what we wanted to capture in that space. So there's a way in which we can use systems that have AI to replace or to sort of outsource a particular sub-process, maybe a navigational system or a language translator system that we don't rely on that often. And that's what we had in mind there. And then moving along this spectrum, there's examples of extended cognition. And these, we think, as you say, require this kind of tight coupling. And then further along the system, we had the idea that what we called it internalized cognition. So we had the idea that there could be some things that are achieved externally by a system. And this might be a system that's operating completely autonomously. But then some of the results of that system could be copied internally by a human. So this is maybe the more abstract one. So I'll just give an example. So if your listeners are familiar with AlphaGo beating the world champion at Go, and they played a series of AlphaGo, sort of the first version, played a series of, I think, three games against Lee Sedol. And I think it was in game two, move 37. Move 37 was seen as this critical move that helped win the game. And a lot of the commentators and experts on Go who were watching the system play had thought that that move was a huge gaffe on the part of AlphaGo. So that it was described as really sort of surprising and thought to be somewhat of an amateur move. I'm not familiar enough with the nuances of Go to say too much more about it. But what ended up happening is that Lee Sedol lost that game and AlphaGo won. And now looking back, a lot of experts are trying to study why AlphaGo made that move and actually trying to learn from that move and other moves that it made. And so in that way, the system has sort of generated this new idea or this new strategy that humans are then trying to understand and use to improve themselves. So that's the kind of examples we have in mind.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good example of that form of internalization. So there's another example which is non-AI based, which I don't know if you'll agree with, so I'll just put it to you and see whether you see that this is a form of internalization. So I heard this guy, David Krakauer, being interviewed once about cognitive extension, and one of the examples he gave was an abacus, and that it's a classic form of cognitive artifact that helps people perform arithmetical operations. But you know, some people can get so proficient at using the abacus that they don't need the physical artifact itself, because they can basically construct a mental model of an abacus inside their minds to help them do addition, subtraction, and so forth. So they're changing the kind of mental algorithm that they use to solve mathematical puzzles, because initially they were reliant on this artifact, but now they've internalized the process. So would that be a kind of illustration of this phenomenon of internalization?
Yeah, I think that's right. And so it's definitely the case that what we have in mind is something that also isn't unique to AI, but it's something that at least AI could do. And then you also, the example that you gave touched on another sort of component of what we described as internalization, which is that once that sort of concept, idea, or representation has been internalized, the device is no longer needed. So if you think about AlphaGo, that could be taken off the face of the earth, but people could still go back and train on that move and understand it. Another example I like to give when I give this talk is Venn diagrams, which is a bit more like the abacus example you gave. So Venn diagrams obviously gives us a way of representing somewhat abstract idea of intersecting sets. But once you have that idea, you don't need to go around drawing Venn diagrams. You kind of have that as a model and a way of thinking.
Right. So I want to maybe offer an objection to this this categorization.
Please.
So you've outlined it as a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
That in a sense you have externalization at one extreme, maybe you disagree with this as well, but externalization at one extreme, internalization at the other, and extension kind of somewhere in the middle. Is that roughly how you're imagining it, or is that incorrect?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense in which Jose and I thought of this originally as a spectrum where autonomous systems were one end of the spectrum. But as I've gone on to think about this, I almost think of it as kind of a circle, because the internalized cognition, the examples I gave of AlphaGo, those were also autonomous systems, but they provided some insight to humans. So you might think that, I don't know how best to visualize this, but basically there's autonomous systems, there's the possibility of using AI as just a tool, there's the possibility of being tightly coupled with AI, and then there's the possibility of AI somehow giving us insight or new concepts.
Yeah, so like the way in which I was thinking about it is that, in a sense, these things tend to overlap in most interesting cases. Like, so there may be some devices that involve kind of purely autonomous or pure externalization. I struggle a little bit to imagine those arising, but I think most cases will probably end up somewhere in between. So a circle is maybe a good mental picture to have when you think about these relationships. I was thinking about a triangle, since there were three initially,
yeah.
But if you're adding autonomy as a separate one, that makes it more complicated. So to give an example here, and I guess it goes to the example you just gave of AlphaGo as well. So like a human who plays chess alongside a computer that plays chess. So I mean that system is designed in a sense to be autonomous and to be independent, but as people know anything about the recent history of chess, although this is increasingly less true, it turned out that humans using chess playing computers to in combination with their own kind of decisions about which computer program to rely upon could be better than the best independent chess playing computer. I think that's no longer true. I think that's turned out that even now the more advanced chess playing programs are better than teams of humans and computers. But for a while, these teams of humans and computers were better.
Mm.
So if you look at what's happening in that case, it seems to me that like you've got partial externalization of a cognitive task, because the chess playing computer is coming up with certain moves or strategies or recommendations. So there's a partial externalization. There is also then kind of a partial internalization, is that the recommendations and suggestions by the chess playing computer are taken on board by the humans and they decide which of the recommendations to follow or which strategy to implement. So they're not thinking about chess in the traditional way of certain moves and games that they might usually decide. They're kind of thinking about it in terms of which recommendations from the computer seem to be most appropriate. And then there's also extension, at least in the sense that if you look at the human plus computer is cognitively better at playing chess than the human left to themselves or the computer left to themselves, at least for some period of time. So it seems that you get all three phenomena built into one case there. Another distinction here that might be useful, so there's this paper written by, I think, a guy called Donald Norman back in the 90s about cognitive artifacts. And he said, like, any kind of relationship between a human and a cognitive artifact, such as an abacus or a piece of paper or whatever, or a computer program, you have to look at it on two different levels. There's kind of the system level of the human plus the artifact. And that can be cognitively extended or augmented. But then you also have to look at it at the personal level, which is, I guess, the human themselves and how they relate to the artifact. And usually what is happening is that the artifact changes the kinds of cognitive task that the human needs to perform to succeed at the overall task. So instead of memorizing lots of chess games, the human just has to be good at picking the best recommendations of the chess playing computer, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, what do you make of that kind of example?
Yeah, I think it's helpful. I think you're right that, so I think in the example you give, I'm really happy to say that there's probably a lot of sort of interesting things going on there, sort of maybe some subprocess being externalized, some coupling of the system, maybe of a different kind of process or cognitive process, and some sort of net gain in terms of internalization. I'm going to have to think a little bit. So I think you had also asked whether there could be, you know, whether we could think of any really pure cases of internalization, externalization, extension. And I'll have to think a little bit more about that. Maybe that you typically get a lot of these things hand in hand. But I do think the AlphaGo example, you know, for the all the people who were just watching that game and not Lisa Dahl who was playing it, let's say, I think that would be a sort of genuine case or sort of pure case of internalization. Externalization, I think maybe you could get a case where you just use an AI system once or twice. There's no real tight coupling there, but it is in somehow an offloading of a sub-process. So in other words, it might be the case that with extended cognition or tight coupling is where you get some of these mixed cases or mixed bags. I have to think more about that. It's interesting. And then the example you gave of Donald Norman's work, which I wasn't familiar with, trying to remember the question you had there, John. Sorry.
So when you think about the relationship between a human and a cognitive artifact, you think about it on two different levels, the system level, like the combination of both of them, and then also the personal levels, like what is the human doing as part of the cognitive task? So, I mean, right. He gives really, as far as I recall, he gives sort of trivial everyday examples of this, so that, you know, if you're using a shopping list to perform your shopping, this is different from trying to remember what you wanted to purchase. So in one case, you have to call up the information from your brain somehow. You have to prompt yourself to recall the relevant information, whereas in the case, you're just looking at a piece of paper and ticking things off as they arise. So there's a difference in the kind of tasks that you need to perform.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. So there's a nice paper by, I think it's Betsy Sparrow and some of her colleagues, Daniel Wagner and someone else. It was in Science in 2011, and it was about the effects of Google on our memory. I don't know if you've read this one. Yeah, so they argue for something similar. So just briefly, what they found is that when participants knew that certain information would be easily accessible to them, information that they needed to complete some task, and they were more likely to remember how and where to access that information rather than remembering the content of the information itself. And so what that suggested was that, you know, as you're saying, that Donald Norman argued that this technology is maybe in some sense redesigning what our task is. It's changing the kinds of things we have to remember, which I think is quite interesting. I think that is probably generally true for a lot of the technologies we use.
Yeah. I mean, one of the examples that I had in mind was like using Google Maps to navigate.
Right.
Right. Because, and I actually discussed this on a previous podcast with Adam Carter and Orestes Palermos. They thought this was a genuine example of a human and an AI program forming a single system. Because they said there was this bidirectional relationship between the two systems, insofar as like where you move physically on the planet changes the dot that represents where you are on the map and changes the directions that you're given. And so that could be true, but it seems to me that it fundamentally changes how we navigate around environments. So instead of trying to mentally remember landmarks or maps in our minds and, you know, figuring out where we're located on a physical space, all we really have to do in this case is just follow our dot around the screen.
Yeah, and I think some people have argued something similar as maybe as a kind of objection to the Otto and Inga case. I'm trying to remember which philosopher this was, but basically the idea that in Otto's case, he has to remember where the notebook is and remember to look at the notebook, whereas Inga just has some sort of direct access to the information about where the museum's located. So the fact that Otto has to go through a sort of different process than Inga suggests that maybe these are distinct phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, this might be one reason as well to get away from the notion of parity and focus more on some concept of extension. So it's not that they're not doing the exact same thing, but the net result is kind of similar.
Yeah.
Or it may even be better. Like, I think I'm much better at finding my way around the world now, thanks to Google Maps, than I used to be. You know?
Yeah. I think the thing that I worry about, sort of a foreshadowing discussion of maybe some of the ethical challenges, is that, you know, when there's a generation of people who are learning only to navigate on Google Maps and have not previously learned how to navigate with physical maps, you know, in that case, there may be no harm done. But it might be the case that we have some sort of, you know, core cognitive capabilities of which higher order capabilities are based on. And if we start outsourcing the lower level tasks before they've really been developed, you know, may there be some kind of harms down the line, or may there be some shortcomings down the line. And I think there's just not a lot of research on the developmental consequences of relying on technology so young.
Yeah, I think that's an important question, particularly for people who are interested in education. It's something that I struggle with all the time. So I teach in a law school. And I guess like one of the things traditionally we do with law students is we get them to memorize lots of case names and details or facts of cases. And I do really question whether we should be doing that nowadays, because when they go out and practice as lawyers, they're almost never going to do that. They're never going to need that skill per se. But then, you know, maybe there is some important value with internalizing a certain amount of information, or just, you know, the sheer ability to remember and recall information with relative ease is handy for them, and practically advantageous. And if they don't learn that skill, it might have other deleterious consequences for their broader cognitive performance. I think that's an important question. I guess this is kind of the challenge of cognitive atrophy that you talk about in the paper a bit, right?
Yeah, that one. And we also talk, I think, a little bit about education and assessment. So how, I mean, just like you're saying, I mean, should we be teaching folks or children, you know, the sort of the core information, or should we be teaching them this sort of higher order skill about how to assess what is good information and what's bad information, and how do I navigate through this world of information? At least for myself, you know, I was sort of taught in the way that you're describing, which is that I was tested a lot just on how good my memory is. Whereas I think kids nowadays, which makes me sound so old, but, you know, they're living in a world that's saturated with information, and it's really easy to get information. And the question that I think sort of one of the challenges is, how do you know what information is good or bad, which is a different skill. But then there's also sort of what you were alluding to as well, which is that should we be training people to and testing people in a way that mirrors how they will be operating in the real world, sort of in the wild, and that is often with technologies at hand.
Yeah, I mean, my reading of some of the educational psychology literature, which I'm not overly familiar with, but I read a bit of it, is because as an academic, you have to do courses on, you know, educational philosophy and theory to teach and stuff. So my sense is that there was a period of time where the focus was very much on critical thinking skills as opposed to knowledge acquisition. So it's not so much that you have to remember information, but you need to just be able to interpret it and manipulate it correctly. And there's been a bit of pushback against that since then by saying that, well, you can't actually really distinguish good information from bad information unless you have some foundational knowledge and understanding of how the world works, that it's actually impossible to disaggregate those two kinds of cognitive performance.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So that might have an impact here on that ethical question about what ought we to be training people to do.
Yeah, that's right. And how ought we be assessing them as well, I think.
Let's talk then about maybe a couple of other ethical objections to the use of AI extension. And again, you discuss a bunch of them in the paper. I guess one that's interesting from a philosophical perspective, and that ties in a lot to this conceptual discussion that we had, has to do with the moral status of the AI extender itself. So to put it maybe glibly, is your smartphone part of who you are now? Do we have such a interdependent bidirectional relationship with these devices that if I destroy your smartphone, it's akin to injuring your body in some way or your mind in some way?
And I know I think it's, is it Adam Carter and Palermos who have a paper on this as well, right?
Right. That was actually the subject of our conversation on this podcast. Okay. So I'll include a link to that previous discussion.
Good, yeah. Good. Do that. I'm going to go click that link later. So, I think that paper is really interesting. And part of what I touched on in that Eon article I wrote, which is sort of, when should we start to consider these things as more than just regular technologies or tools? And I'm not totally sure where I fall on that yet. I mean, I'm definitely compelled by the idea that, you know, someone taking my phone, and let's also imagine that it's a phone where, you know, it's not backed up on the cloud, or someone erasing my cloud, let's say, affects me much more, and I think is morally less appropriate, I guess, or more wrong than just taking a sort of another piece of property that I have, maybe, a bag or something. And that really has to do with the kind of information that's on it. So it has personal information, it has private information, it has important information, and all of that seems a lot more like the kind of protections we give our bodies and our brains as sort of an intimate part of me. So I'm pretty sympathetic to that kind of argument. I'm still not sure if it would be something we would treat as, just as morally wrong as harming one's brain or body. But I think that there's a real case to be made that the moral status of cognitive extenders ought to be taken seriously.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that part of it, though, has to do with the uniqueness and replaceability of the extender itself or what it does in your life.
That's
so,
right.
I mean, you kind of touched upon this in the answer you just gave when you mentioned, well, assuming it's not backed up to the cloud. So that's kind of an important assumption that's doing a good bit of work in that illustration. Mm-hmm. But if I recall correctly, when I discussed this with Adam Carter and Orestes Palermos, they had another example. They said, well, there's a dangerous kind of slippery slope here. If you focus too much on replaceability as being what's important, what's doing the kind of moral work, which is that, imagine in the future that you can destroy somebody's leg and replace it with a functionally equivalent or superior prosthetic. Does that acquire a level of triviality? Does the body become kind of a property in that case? So it can maybe work both ways in this.
Yeah, sense. Yeah, that's a great example. And I think the other another important part of this discussion is that destruction is not the only harm.
Yeah.
So you might think just viewing and just breaking into and reading my information is, it's just not just as harmful as destroying it, but it certainly is a harm. And it's a harm that's distinct from, maybe looking through, my closet or something. And again, for the very reasons we mentioned.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So the destruction of the artifact isn't the only thing that's important here. So as you say, there may be basic privacy concerns, but there's also another concern here, which actually links to the ethical objection that I think is most worrisome here or concerning, which has to do with just interfering in a process. So assuming that a human forms this kind of tight coupled relationship with an AI extender, isn't there a problem here that these AI extenders are not really under the control of the human and that they can be controlled by third-party actors like Google, let's say in the case of Google Maps or whatever illustration you want to have, and that this will have impacts on individual autonomy and control over your life and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's one of the ways in which it really distinguishes AI extenders from traditional artifacts and even from socially extended cognition, because typically cases that get described as socially extended cognition cases are when there's a sort of highly interdependent couple or people who have a really stable, reliable relationship. And at least in that case, well, typically it would be a consensual thing and you would have some trust in just one person who has a kind of symmetrical relationship to you. Whereas in the case of an AI extender, there's a really asymmetrical relationship where this company knows a whole lot about you and has the capacity to manipulate you, and there's no symmetry there. So I think it poses a whole different kind of risk.
So like, what are the implications of that then for people who are creating these devices or for policymakers or regulators who want to figure out, how we should regulate the use of AI extenders?
Yeah. I mean, so one thing we talk about in the paper, albeit a bit briefly, is that AI developers, I think, should be, in the first case, aware that there are these, you know, really distinct applications of what they're building, and that it's not always for an autonomous system, but in a lot of cases, it can be for, you know, a system that plays a really critical role in someone's life. And when that is the case, you know, that they ought to treat that somewhat differently. To be thinking about sort of some of the design features and the fact that there may need to be more privacy protection, that there may need to be more of an understanding of how the system works for the user. There needs to be more thought in the interface level. So it may be the case that you don't want something to be, you know, prompting and buzzing and sort of doing the kinds of things that lead to addictive behaviors, depending on the application. So just sort of, I guess, more thought about some of the secondary effects of how that's will impact a user. And then in the case of policymakers, I think somewhat similarly, I mean, in this paper, we were just trying to draw awareness to the fact that there are all these other applications of AI where typically in the mainstream media and in policy discussions, the focus really has been on autonomous systems. So focus has been on, you know, robots that are going to replace our workers or take jobs or self-driving cars, where there's, you know, this whole other space that really isn't being talked about or handled appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key message from your paper, and I probably should have emphasized it more earlier in the conversation, which is that there is this distinct class or phenomenon of the way in which people rely upon or work with AI, and too much of the policy discussion has been focused on the autonomous cases, and I think that's exactly right. You have this great phrase in your paper about the fear of creating extended zombies. I mean, so is that just the notion of people who are excessively dependent on some kind of an external system and they completely cognitively atrophied or something as a result of it, or they're addicted to the content that it provides? Like, what's the issue there?
Yeah. I think the thought is these kind of maybe somewhat hyperbolic situations, but in my sort of in my direction which I'm going, I was also thinking about ways in which machine or AI systems can use us as extenders or humans as extenders as tools, and there's some interesting examples of that. So it's not just, you know, it's not just the case that we use technology, but now more than ever, technology is using us. And it's those kinds of cases where we're really not being thought of as sort of Kantian autonomous agents, rational agents, but really just being used either to collect information or to maybe even offload responsibility onto us and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, what this brings to mind actually is another conversation I had with Brett Frischman and Evan Selinger, where they talk about one of the concerns with technology, particularly digital technologies nowadays, is that it's turning humans into simple stimulus response machines where, you know, you've got an option, click here to consent or click here to agree, and people don't really rationally reflect on things. They just click on whatever the notification is and respond positively or affirmatively. And maybe in that sense, they're becoming kind of zombie-like in their interaction with technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's definitely it's that idea, which I think also ties into the idea that a lot of that consent is not really informed or voluntary if you need the technology to operate in the world. And then also, you know, just thinking about who's benefiting from the use of this tool, and who really has the control in that relationship. So a bit of what we discussed.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. And I think that's, again, as I say, that seems to me as probably to me anyway, that's one of the big fears about this, this phenomenon and what differentiates it from, as you mentioned, that, you know, the past examples of cognitive artifacts, which, you know, my notebook seems to be much more under my control than my smartphone. And that's something that I worry about.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so I think we'll leave it there. Where can people, you know, find out more about your work and what you're doing?
Well, I keep my website pretty updated, so you can go to kkvd.com. And I think, yeah, that's probably the best. I'm also on the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence's website, and always happy to talk to anyone. So you can find my email online if you'd like to get in touch.
Yeah, thanks. I'm very impressed by the fact that you have a four-letter website. That's
Fourletter.com.
yeah,
Yeah, that
so
was
very.
actually a treasured gift from my partner when we started dating. He runs a he's a sort of in domain acquisitions.
Okay, so it's a very rare thing to have. So I'm impressed that an academic has it. Yeah.
I'm
Anyway.
impressed that an academic appreciates it, so thanks, John.
Okay. All right. So thanks for talking to me today, Karina.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.